over at you on the camera screen here, and I think 6 months into quarantine, and that haircut, Brad, or lack of haircut, I got to tell you, it's getting more and more extreme, my friend.
I refuse to go to a barber or a haircut place. I just don't want, I refuse to be anywhere where I'm indoors with people, whether I've got a mask on or a mask off. And if I'm, obviously if I'm outdoors, I've got a mask on, but it doesn't matter. Mask, no mask. I'm not going to some haircut place. I don't care. Well, I'm letting it go.
Your hair is looking more and more, and I say this with somewhat of a compliment, how in the 30s when they would portray Dracula on film, and there would be like wisps, like it wasn't perfectly slicked back. There was like wisps that would pop out and curls that would pop out and be like, hello, welcome to my castle. You're looking more and more like a 1930s Dracula.
Yeah, I've got these, especially on the sides above my ears, I've got these long wisps that come out from either end and curl upwards. And of course it helps that they're gray and the rest of my hair is black, so they stick right out. I kind of look like Uncle Marvel, but with a little bit more hair on top.
What a reference! Or a non-red-haired Bozo the Clown. Either one of those, you know?
Yeah, I've got it. And you know what? Part of it's a mark of pride, because if somebody goes down the street and they see me with my mask on, they know that I'm keeping quarantine. You know, this guy isn't going indoors anywhere. He's keeping it real.
This is like the equivalent of the World War II, where you're like, you're collecting rubber and plastic scraps for the war effort.
Yeah.
Like, you with hair like that is letting your fellow men and women know that you're like, I'm doing my part for quarantine.
Doing my part. And part of it, I mean, and as much as I teased you about artist hands, the fact of the matter is that I know for a fact that if I tried to pull off what you did, I'd draw blood. They'd be taking me to a hospital, and that's indoors.
What's great, though, is looking at this haircut on you, and up to like 6 weeks ago when I had that hair on me when it was ridiculously long, is that I just realized that the 1970s was a decade without quality control. Like, everybody just looked stupid in the 70s. Everybody, no matter who you are, where you came from, what you look like, nobody had a good haircut in the 70s. We all look stupid.
No, it was no quality control is a great way to put it. And part of it is the sides are getting ridiculous. I might actually try to trim the sides. Part of me is like, you know, I'm 51 years old. This might be my last chance to see how long I can get it to grow in the back. Like,
yeah, chance for a man bun, Brad. Everybody's dying to see the Brad Dagger man bun.
Ponytail, mate. Well, I don't know. Man bun, never. Ponytail, maybe. But I want to see if I can get it to come down as far as to the shoulders. And I've got about an inch yet to go.
Oh, my God. You could do that by Christmas.
Yeah. By Christmas, I might be able to get it to come down to the shoulders.
Oh, my God. The kids are going to have hippie Santa in the house. How nice.
This is my
last
chance.
Hey, you kids. Everybody getting a little bit of something for the ass. Hey, how you doing? Merry Christmas.
Yeah, man, I was in my sleigh and it was really wild. They had the reindeer, man.
Hey, it's fantastic. Hey, have you ever experienced time on your skin, man? Oh, it feels like time.
Anyway, yeah, the 1970s was basically a gigantic experiment where everybody was like, hey, what if all of us, the entire country, didn't care how we looked? What if that was a thing?
What if that? Yeah, like, what if we wore pants that just went super wide, just at the ankle? Let's do that.
How about if all of us got avocado green wallpaper? What are we all cool with that? That sounds like fun.
Only if we can have, you know, haystack meadow yellow with it, that'll be just fine. And lots of brown. You know what we got to do? Lots of browns. Who's been using browns lately? Nobody but us in the 70s.
What do we feel about houses that all of which imply bodily functions? How about that? What if we have painted our entire houses to imply bodily functions? And we designed cars that look like the AMC Pacer or the AMC Gremlin. Remember those things?
But remember, what was it? Was it the El Camino that was a car in the front and a truck in the back?
You know what, though? That's where I draw the line, because that El Camino was actually kind of cool. And I think Ford had the Ranchero, which was their version, but the El Camino was cooler looking.
Yeah, the El Camino always confused me. Is it a car? Is it a truck? What is? And why would you give up all that space in the back?
Speaking of stoners, I don't know about you, but growing up in Southern California, Brad,
yeah,
the El Camino was owned by a specific kind of dude when I was a young kid.
Yeah,
and it was either a contractor who the back of the Camino was just covered in paint flecks,
yep,
or a stoner surfer who's like, "Hey man, yeah, we got a 5-foot swell this morning. I'm gonna be a little bit late for work." You know, that kind of guy.
Some waves, man.
Yeah.
It's having just gotten done with a major house renovation, and here's a little spoiler alert: we're starting a new one in a month.
No, Brad, no.
It's a smaller project.
I didn't know this. What's happening?
It's a smaller project, but part of we're not going anywhere.
Is this one of those
time.
Things where if you repaint a room, then you suddenly realize the table looks like shit, and then you replace the table, and then you're like, oh, now the chairs look like shit, and then that kind
well,
of thing?
That is happening, too. It's like, well, we can't have these old tables. We can't. We bought a lot of new furniture and stuff, but no, we want a deck out back. Because it's like we're not going anywhere for a long time. We might as well build as much room into this as we can. And because, God only knows when we're actually pulling out of this thing. And we had planned to go to Disney this year. Well, that went up in smoke. You know, we had planned to take a number of trips. Those went up in smoke. So it's like, well, we've got a little bit of money to play with. We can do this. We can do that. So, yeah, we're starting a new project in a month. But having just that view of the painter driving up in the El Camino, I got to tell you, that's a whole a strata of culture is painters. Like you can tell, these are all guys that are they're living. I think they're living their best life. You know, man, nobody. They go from job to job, and they're good at what they do, but they don't really have from my standpoint, and I'm sure they'd tell you different. They don't have a lot of people lording over them. They're they're living great lives. You know,
well, one of the things because I've been for my in-laws, I've been dealing with a lot of contractors on their behalf, mm-hmm. and one of the things that's interesting about contractors is, boy, if they don't want to go to work that day, they just don't show up. I'm not coming in today. No, about it. You're coming in. No, I'm not coming in.
That's what I mean by nobody to lord over them. You know, it's like when we were coming down to the wire, I said, this painter didn't show up. And he says, oh, yeah, that happens. I'm like, well, we're going to try another painter. They literally said, this guy's not showing up for 2 days. We'll get somebody else. They called that guy, had him all scheduled. He didn't show up.
Which is a lot like Brad's hair.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not showing up in the back, that's for sure.
Well, I gotta say, what's nice about this long 1970s hair is there is not a hint of baldness anywhere on Brad Geiger. Because right now I'm looking over at you and I just see lush growth. I just see like this. It's like someone's poured Miracle-Gro all over your hair.
That's the other good thing about it is this is also my last best attempt at a good comb over. The only thing I'm happy about turning bald is that a good man always comes out on top.
I had to think about that. A good man always comes
the
out
good
on
thing, top. The only thing I say about being bald is a good man always comes out on top.
The only thing? Am I the dumbest person alive? I don't get this. The only
A good
thing-
man comes out on top, like the top of his head comes out of his hair.
Boy, that's a long walk for that
really?
Play on words. That genuinely got me. Usually I'm like, wink, I get it. And that one, I was like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. Like, I think I actually went silent for 10 seconds. Like, my brain was like, what is he saying?
Not only silent, but on the screen you froze like a deer in the headlights. It's like, oh my God, he's having a stroke.
I broke Dave. Dave, you smell burnt toast. On that note, I am going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his pal, Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and the co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So, Dave, Let's talk comics.
Let's start comics, my friend. And you had a topic that I wanted to jump right into this week because you had brought this up earlier. And I thought, how fun to roll this into the show. And it was the importance of setting an emotional hook in the opening pages of your story. Now, give everybody a little bit of a background of where this sprang from in your mind, because you've been helping somebody out on the first three pages of their story.
Well, so we've been talking a lot about how to begin a story well. How important, if you remember just a few episodes ago, we talked about the 8-page rule and how important it is to capture your reader in those first 8 pages. And we've talked a lot about the importance of an in media res opening, where you open with action. Of course, that's by the way, we've got to put a little comma there. It's not the only way to capture your reader in the opening pages, but it's one that we talk about a lot because it's one that is very effective. And if you're not sure how to open your story, it's kind of one that you might not be thinking of. You might be thinking about your story chronologically, and you're saying, okay, well, in the beginning, this guy was born, and then he grew up. And nobody, you know, chronological might not be the best way to tell the story. Might be better for an in media res opening.
Right.
And as I'm seeing some people put this into effect, it occurs to me that we need to talk about this opening pages thing a little bit more, in that we need to talk about the importance of setting an emotional hook.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's not enough to be enticed. It's not enough to be excited. It's not enough to have your eyes dance across a page.
Yeah.
It's the importance of caring. You know, like, why do I care about it? Like, for anyone who's ever watched a new TV show and you feel it in your gut 10 minutes in, you're like, I don't care about any of this.
Yes.
Okay, there's a lot of banging of drums and I don't care. My heart doesn't, I don't give a shit about any of these characters, you know?
Yeah, and what happens very often, if you see somebody who doesn't heed this kind of advice, what happens is you end up getting an in media res opening that doesn't matter. In other words, you'll open with a big car chase, and you'll have 3 pages of action, 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 car chase, car chase, car chase, and it's very exciting. The problem is, once I get to a certain point in this car chase, I'll read maybe 3 pages. If I get to the 4th page and I don't care about who's behind the wheel of one of those cars, I'm not going to make it to the 5th.
Yeah. You know what's funny? It's funny you should say the word car chase, because a movie just popped into my head that actually suffers from this exact problem with a car chase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, which opens with a car chase that is useless story-wise. Do you remember this? It was the Russians who were pretending to be American soldiers, literally racing across the desert with a souped up coupe with a bunch of teens in it.
Yeah.
Remember? And it's 3 to 5 minutes of that. And it actually adds nothing to the story, other than at the very end, you realize that they're Russians. Like, but there's a lot of problems with that movie. But it's a particularly good movie to show as something that needed to be script doctored 4 more times, because that movie does not hold up. But anyway. Yes. So let's compare that to a movie where the emotional hook does work. And one that pops into my mind where it's good is Guardians of the Galaxy. And
Let's hear it.
So you start off with a strong emotional beat, which obviously there's versions of that. And music is an amazing thing for movies. But for comics, the visuals are what we can do and employ best, right, in a musical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Starts off with a strong musical note. He's confident. He's dancing around. He's delightfully kicking lizard creatures across the swamp, right? He successfully breaks in. We're already intrigued about who this person is. He's feeling confident, heroic. And then one of the soldiers breaks in with his giant cannon pointed at him. And we realize very quickly through his dialogue that he's actually a scared, insecure kid that just wants to be called Star-Lord, even though he's doing all these tremendously heroic things. And so you're immediately like, I recognize that. I am that nerd.
Right.
You know? And so you're by even as a solo monologue, you're like, I get it. I get who that person is.
Mm-hmm.
He's confident outwardly, inwardly, incredibly insecure. And so you're hooked, you know?
It's a moment of empathy. It's a moment of psychological or emotional connection with somebody who's like, oh, yeah, they're like me.
Yes.
And that's an empathy that you see used over and over again. The example that I always use to my storytelling class is if you really want to see this done on a master's class level, In my opinion, watch the beginning of almost any Disney animated feature.
Oh, and that's a better example. Yeah.
You'll see them set the emotional hook in the first 10 minutes. The go-to example is the movie Up, where they show you that person's life through little snippets of the life.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't have you in tears, you know, by the first 60 seconds, check for a pulse. You may have passed away sometime there after you hit the play button.
Right.
But Beauty and the Beast is also a great one.
Oh, Beauty and the Beast is fantastic, with the song especially. Yes.
She's trouncing through this French provincial village, and think about the emotions that she's sharing. She's very happy. She's very kind. The other people and particularly the animals are all reacting favorably towards her, which tells us that she's nice, she's kind, she's friendly. But every emotional note that she talks about wanting something bigger, being happy, but wanting more, wanting her life to start, knowing that she's ready for the next step. And these are the emotions of all of us when we're teenagers.
Right.
You know?
And in fact, it's funny you should say that, because Rapunzel in Tangled has an almost identical line of, when does my life begin? You know?
Yeah.
And that's a universal for, frankly, it doesn't even need to be, it can be a 51-year-old long-haired Brad Geiger who's like, when does my life begin? You know?
Yes.
You know? What I'm saying is, that's a universal that, yes, it's absolutely geared towards kids, but
generalize. I'd sign off on generalize.
Wait, is generalize a word? No, I don't think so.
If it isn't, it certainly should be.
They generalize it enough such that it's immediately empathetic and sympathetic towards most people's existence, which is, I want more. I wish I was doing more with my life, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, because you never outgrow that. It's most intense when you're a teenager, but you never outgrow that, or at least I haven't been able to outgrow that. There's still those notes in my own subconscious of, I want to do more. I want things that are still unattainable at this point.
Right.
But those are all common things. You've got to give us a reason to care about what's happening. Again, if you want to go back to that 8 pages rule that we talked about, your 8 pages not only have to be, exciting in an action sense, or again, in media res is not the only way to do it. It's just one of the ways that we talk about here. That is going to be, you know, helpful for you to think about. However, your first 8 pages has to answer 2 questions. And if your pages can't answer these questions, you're in real trouble. And here's the 2 questions. Why is the character doing this? And why do I care?
Oh, why is this character doing this?
In other words, it could be, it doesn't have to be both of them, but I guess what I'm trying to get out is, here's some questions that your emotional hook is going to be found under, okay? In other words, why is the character doing this? Why is it important that the character does this? Or why do I care about the character? Or what's at stake in this action? Is the earth in the balance? Is there a small child that will fall into a hole? You know, nobody wants to see a defenseless child fall into a hole. Is that what's going to happen? Is the village going to be destroyed by the evil conquerors? What's at stake? Or why do I care about this character? Why do I want the action to be successful or unsuccessful? You've got to give the reader a reason to care about turning the next page.
I went quiet there because I was genuinely thinking how I would apply those 2 questions to stories that I have done.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that in a lot of ways, I'm just impressed by you, because that's a better theory of comic making than I had in my own internal compass. And thank you for giving me those 2 questions, because I personally had not thought of it that way. So, I guess what I'm saying is, even pretty good storytellers, of which I include myself, you intuit it, but it's nice to have it put into concrete terms. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's nice when someone crystallizes it for you and go, oh, yeah, those are specific questions I should be asking. And I don't know that I had that in my toolkit, Brad. So I'm going to go back and write those down, because that's actually good for a story that I'm starting pretty soon. Thank you for that.
That's interesting. Well, and frankly, there are, I'm sure if you sat and thought about it, you'd come up with other questions that you could answer as well. You know,
right.
but I think what it's at the heart of it is and let's go back to that 8 pages rule, because you know how I kind of sometimes like rules of thumb in this regard. By 8 pages, you should have given your reader an emotional reason to turn to page 9. And if all of you've given them is action, which is, by the way, remember, a good start. If all you've given them is action, if all you've given them is things happening and not the why part, mm-hmm. and then it's going to be really hard to justify an emotional reason to turn to page 9.
Can I juxtapose something mm-hmm. with you that we've not talked about previously, but I think there might be something to this. So you are positing this as an 8-page rule, like by page 8, they need a reason to get to page 9, right?
Right.
And you're familiar, of course, with film, the 15-minute rule, that by minute 15, you have to have given the reason why someone should want to see the rest of the story, mm-hmm. right? Basically the launching off point for the rest of the story. Oh, no, now we see why Thor has to go do the thing. Now we see why the Chariots of Fire runners have to go do the thing, whatever it is. Yeah. Whatever the movie is, at the 15-minute mark, you want to have laid out the fundamental crux of what your story is going to be about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here is my thought. How long do you think it takes to read 8 pages, just out of curiosity?
Well, I know where you're going, and I'll flip over all of the cards and say and tell you this. When I started using some similar templates to do my writing by, and remember I told you quite a while ago that I had found a really good sitcom writing template that said, yeah. here's, you know, how a sitcom unfolds in 22 minutes. And I thought, geez, that's very close to 22 pages for a floppy comic.
Yeah.
So my answer is, for me, when I'm thinking in these terms, I do a straight 1 minute to 1 page equivalency.
Right.
In other words, I'd say that 15 minutes is equivalent to 15 pages.
Yeah. So it's, I guess what I'm getting at is it's interesting that no matter what the media in terms of entertainment is, there's a certain spectrum of time towards the front where like you need to have mm-hmm. You need to get the goods out by that point. And so while I don't know if 8 is the hard and fast rule, it's certainly as good as any other page to say, listen, You really need to have hooked him by that point. And if you haven't, then you haven't done your job, you know?
Well, yeah. And again, as much as I do like something like a rule of thumb that I can reference back to, the fact of the matter is let's say it takes you 9 pages to set an emotional hook, but you've set that emotional hook amazingly well. Okay, good enough. Let's say it took you 15. If you do it super effectively, then it might be worth the risk for those extra pages. What I'm encouraging you to do is to do whatever it takes. If you had 15 pages and you set an amazing hook on page 15, I would tell you to take a good look at those pages and see if there was any way that you could reformat or edit or do something to get that closer to the beginning, like mm-hmm. maybe 10 pages or 9 or even 8. But if everything you've got there is rock solid and could not possibly be taken out, if it takes you 15 in that circumstance, then go for 15. But the overriding principle is get to that sooner.
I super agree. And Brad, since you are in a nice philosophical mood,
mm-hmm.
I would like to talk more about a little bit of the philosophy of being a creator. And
yeah.
you had brought up that famous Ira Glass quote about mm-hmm. The internal editor versus the internal critic versus the internal creative abilities, right?
Yeah.
And so I would like to read this quote, and then we'll jump in on this, because you had some interesting thoughts in our conversation the other day. So Ira Glass of This American Life writes, "Nobody tells this to people who are beginners. I wish someone told me. All of us who do creative work, we get into it because we have good taste, but there is this gap. For the first couple of years you make stuff, it's not that it's good. It's trying to be good. It has potential, but it's not. But your taste, the thing that got you into the game, is still killer. And your taste is why your work disappoints you. A lot of people never get this past this phase. They quit. Most people I know who do interesting creative work went through years of this. We know our work doesn't have this special thing that we want it to have. We all go through this. And if you are just starting out or you're just still in this phase, you got to know it's normal. And the most important thing you can do is do a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Put yourself on a deadline so that every week you will finish one story. It is only by going through a volume of work that you will close that gap, and your work will be as good as your ambition. And I took longer to figure out how to do this than anyone I've ever met. It's going to take a while. It's normal to take a while. You've just got to fight your way through. Brad, so Ira, in one of the better summaries I think that I've seen in the last 10 or 20 years, mm-hmm. talks about the fact that we have this critical eye. We can appreciate what is, for example, good art.
Right.
And yet our hands physically, our mind chemically can't yet form that good storytelling that we know is what is necessitated to be considered good art, right? Mm-hmm. The critic is better than the artist. But you had some interesting thoughts on this, and I would love to hear your counterpoint to Ira on this.
Number one, I really appreciate that he's talking about aesthetics, because that's really what it comes down to. Every right. one of us have different levels of skill, but and that's something that can only be built, you know, like you said, with more and more and more practice. But it really is about aesthetic. It's about the ability to see that you're not quite there yet.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
In other words, aesthetic is saying, I know where it's supposed to be and it's not there. And if
right.
and when I was just starting out, I knew Greystone Inn wasn't there yet, you know, because I knew what it was supposed to be, but I couldn't get it there. And I kept at it and I lived for those little moments where it got a little closer.
Yes, yes, you know? Yes.
And it's like, okay, now I get it. Not, and then, and it was like, but I still wasn't there. But you
saw an inkling of leveling up and you got excited. You
got
know?
A glimpse of it. You got a glimpse is what yeah. you live for. The problem, the only thing is, sometimes it's really hard for me to believe when I see that people are focusing on the aesthetic. Because sometimes I see work that is just, it's almost like going through the motions. And it's like, it's hard to see that they have a sense of aesthetic. And I want to believe what Ira says. In other words, what Ira says is all people who do creative work get into it because they have good taste. That's the only part that I kind of disagree with. I think some people get into it for any number of reasons. Maybe they think it would be fun. Maybe they think that it would be lucrative. They get into it for a lot of different reasons. And you can see by the stuff they're putting out, it's hard for me to believe they've got good taste. And I know that sounds...
Stop looking at my work, Brad.
No, I know that sounds cruel having just said what I said, because we all start out at a low level.
Right.
But there's
right.
some that is there's such a disconnect between what's good and some of it is just like I keep going back to word balloons. If you're doing word balloons where your lettering is touching the line of your word balloon, that is such a simple aesthetic. And it's something that's so simple to fix. It's right there in front of you. In other words, I get that you can't draw a tree the way you want to draw a tree, right? That's
right.
something that you practice with. But something like that is so careless that it makes me wonder if you do have an aesthetic, because any basic aesthetic would say, wait a minute, pull that out a little bit, especially drawing digitally. Just make that so it doesn't touch. Your aesthetic would force you to do that. And the fact that I see this happening over and over and over again with, and that's just one example. It's the same thing with leading. When people use the leading that came with Clip Studio, which is way too wide, and they've got lines of text that are way separated. That's the sort of thing that you should be able to see immediately. Wait a minute, that doesn't look good. I'm going to tighten up that leading. Even though that's the leading that came with Clip Studio, I'm going to tighten that up.
I don't know how far
I can sign off on this.
So it's interesting that both of your examples were lettering. And I'll tell you why, because
yeah.
both of those are self-evidently technical abilities, right?
Yeah.
They're not even artistic flair necessarily. We both agree that lettering can be artistic. What I'm saying is, at its bare bones level, not touching a letter to a word balloon is a technical problem. That's mm-hmm. like, no, you needed to have started your word literally a 16th of an inch over, right?
Right.
Like, So the problem is not that you can't draw a tree. The problem is that you didn't nudge this over. And that's more of a technical problem, right?
Right.
So I would actually argue that it's more akin to climbing a ladder than this gap that you're trying to close in the way that Ira described it. By the way, I think maybe even Ira would agree with this in the sense that your right hand is your critical abilities to see what's good and what's not. Mm-hmm. Your left hand, as you go up the ladder, is your technical and creative abilities to bring what you see in your mind's eye into the world, right?
Right.
And so as you climb up the ladder of your career, and here I am actually climbing a ladder.
Yeah, you're doing very good pantomime right now. Now do the one where you're inside of a box. Yeah, I love that one.
Look, Brad, I'm sipping tea. Oh, I'm really good at miming. So what I'm getting at, though, is that I have noticed that sometimes I have leveled up in my art skills, but my inner critic is not as good. Like, I need to expose myself to more work that's of really high quality. Like, I need to look at Jim Lee's pages for a while. I need to look at Carl Kershaw's pages for a while to get better at my critical eye so that my skill set can be challenged more. Does that make sense?
That's pretty fair, yeah.
What I'm getting at is I personally feel like the gap is for one thing, it's always there.
Yeah.
But it's not always in one direction, and it is a constant challenge in dance, but that's what makes it fun. And have you ever had this, by the way, Brad? Sometimes I will get done with an amazing page. And by the way, this is the kind of insight that I think only comes after having cartooned for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I will get done with an amazing page in Drive. And I'm like, God, that's beautiful. I'm really proud of how I did that. I did that star field and that planet and that starship exactly how I wanted to do it, right? Whatever it is. And sometimes I'll go to close the file and I'll be like, I wonder how shitty I'm going to think this looks in 5 years.
Yeah, there is, you know? That. Yeah.
Like, I know in my heart, I'm so proud of it. Because what happens is when you're 20 years into a career like I am, I go back to my archives from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and the inner Dave remembers being so proud of that page. And, oh, I thought the line work was just perfect. And now I look at it and I go, oh, what? Well, I mean, it's okay.
Yeah.
But with a couple of tweaks, that could have been really good, you know?
You know what? I think you've got the better line on this, in that the problem with the way that I was thinking about this was that aesthetic was a constant.
Yeah, it's not. It's not. Aesthetic is not a constant.
And what you're pointing out is very true, that aesthetic, it may start at a high. In other words, you may have your aesthetic might be at a 10, and that gets you into drawing comics. And then in drawing comics, your aesthetic grows to a 20.
Right.
And then as you keep going, your aesthetic grows to a 30. And at some point, you might have a very, very finely tuned, well-developed, well-nurtured aesthetic. I think that's the problem that I was having, is that I was considering aesthetic as a constant. And it's not. It's something that you develop and you nurture.
It's kind of like when you put a fish into a bowl. The bigger you put the fish bowl, or the bigger a bowl you put the fish in, they're going to keep growing and growing and growing and growing, right?
Right.
So part of what we and 1,000 other artists always advise is to, like, keep reading, keep exploring, keep paying attention to what other people are doing, because you need to grow your aesthetic, you need to change your aesthetic, you need to keep honing your critical eye so that your skill set can get better. Because, yes, you could become a really good technical artist that no one would fault. But your aesthetic needs to keep growing, because you need to keep challenging that technical artist in the same way that, for example, Picasso, incredibly talented technical painter. And people always forget the earlier part of his career, like incredible realist, incredible a painter of portraiture and that kind of thing. But he realized that as his aesthetic got more advanced, that actually simpler lines, more caricatured lines, more abstract lines were an interesting way to recreate the world and emotions and feelings of his world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, as his aesthetic grew, it's not that he got technically more better. It's that he got technically more creative and more experimental. And that's the interesting, too, to see with cartoonists. Because I have seen cartoonists. I'm thinking of, who's the guy with the editorial cartoonist with the little nose that is in the corner? Oliphant?
If he looks like a penguin, it's Oliphant.
Okay, so yes, it is Oliphant. Mm-hmm. So Pat Oliphant is the Australian who came to America, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. Mm-hmm. If you get a second, look up, Brad, early Pat Oliphant versus Pat Oliphant now.
Oh, really?
Because Pat Oliphant realized somewhere in the 80s that his hyper-detailed, hyper-realistic, hyper-accurate line work was not as effective in making a political cartoon statement as caricatured, simple lines, overly scratchy, not as perfect, lines aren't closed, that kind of thing. You know, mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is, as his aesthetic grew, he technically became a, quote, worst artist, but it was right. more effective, you know?
And maybe more of a challenge, you know? Because as an artist, you're always looking for another challenge. And that's what I think about when I think about Picasso. It's like, okay, he got to the point where he could do that perfectly realistic painting of a horse. Now he needed a new challenge. And right. his aesthetic led him to that.
And it's worth mentioning, too, that Picasso was unfortunate for a lot of young artists, in that everyone thought, oh, well, I can skip learning how to draw realistically.
Right.
I can just go right to making weird shapes and weird faces. Whereas mm-hmm. the reason Picasso could do that was he had the basis, the knowledge, the technical skill as to why a face was shaped the way it was shaped and all that sort of stuff.
So now we've come full circle. That's where sometimes, if somebody's getting criticism and then they say, well, that's just my aesthetic. It's like, well, okay, but let's back up here.
Yeah.
you can't use that's my aesthetic to hand wave away constructive criticism that
hey,
you're
Brad,
getting.
We can role play. Like, hey, Brad, what do you think of my crappy comics?
Oh, listen, I think you need to do a little bit of work on your line quality.
No, that's my aesthetic.
Okay, well, but you've got the text touching the word balloons.
Nope, that's my aesthetic.
Here's the thing. I'm actually getting angry as you're doing this. God damn it! You're gonna listen to me
because everybody holds up the one example where, and yes, it's true. But the exception doesn't always prove the point, which is, you do want to technically get better, and because only in getting technically better can you then intentionally step away from the technically accurate drawing to make the better point emotionally or the better expression creatively. Mm-hmm. But you have to start from a point of trying to get technically good first, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think we can all see that looking back. I mean, now that we're talking about that in this terms as aesthetic as a growable feature, I look back on the stuff that I was doing originally, you know, 2000, 2001, I was so happy that I was getting an image, you know, like I was so happy I got an image on a website and that the image made sense. It was like, I'm at the top of my game. I've got an image. It's on a website. It's readable. Yeah, this is great. And it wasn't until my aesthetic grew that I was like, okay, there's some things we need to fix here, you know. And that's the journey that we're talking about.
But I think one of the things that Ira Glass says really well in that quote, which is that it's only through going through a volume of work that you close that gap.
Yeah.
And so even though I say that the aesthetic is growing, is changing, it's expanding, right? Whether you think of the metaphor as a ladder that you're climbing up or as a new fishbowl that you've placed yourself into, a bigger and broader fishbowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do agree that only in doing the work does your eye get better, your hand get better, that dance between mind and expression and what you draw get better. And it's always so tragic to me that quote, and I think it was Miyazaki who in his 70s was like, now I think I'm finally ready to be a good artist.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, God. Like at once you're like, how wonderful, but also like, oh, God, how terrible. In his 70s, he's finally feeling good about it. You know, it's like, oh.
You know, the sad thing is I know exactly what he felt like.
Yeah.
I know exactly what he meant.
Yeah. Yeah, I get inklings of that. I'm not yet. I have always said since my like mid-30s, I'm about 10 years away from being good.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if I'm going to be saying that still at like 75.
Yeah.
Like, I'm about 10 years away from being good.
That's what I mean. I think maybe by 70, I'll be ready to be a good artist. I know.
That's when the bus hits you.
Yeah, no kidding. That's that's when the doctor says, well, sit down. We got to talk.
In general, though, I think it is also reassuring to know that every artist you have ever loved feels that gap.
Yes.
You know, that's also reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Watterson still feels that gap. I know because I've talked to him that it's like what you want to be drawing and painting is different than what you're actually able to physically do.
Right.
Either by the technical abilities of your hand or that weird communication between brain and hand. And so it's both comforting and an inspiration that we are all working to close that gap that Ira Glass talks about. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. All right, Brad, our next question comes in from Dave Lerner of patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave writes, hello, B&D. B&D.
B&D.
B&D sounds like a kind of sandwich you might get on a Philly street. Like, you want a B&D?
You can't give me a B&D. Hold the mayo.
I'll have a B&D. No sausages on the B&D. All right, B says, hello, B&D. You advise me not to go on Patreon. You said, quote, don't start with Patreon, build an audience, then monetize them on Patreon when you're ready. Okay, I know I'm not ready yet. I've only been doing this about 3.5 months. But how do I know when I am ready? Is there a minimum number? Do I wait for people to say they'd support me on Patreon? But does Geiger's Law, the first person to comment that they'd buy a certain type of merchandise as the first person to disappear when the merch is offered, apply to Patreon? And would it be bad if I went to Patreon before I had a reasonable number of followers? Thank you. I love the show, and I am only a handful of episodes from catching up on the backlog. Then it's time for pro tips. That's exciting, because we have a few hundred hours now of show, I think, Brad, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here's the deal. First of all, I reached out to Dave and I said, when did we tell you that you couldn't start a Patreon? And he says, oh, no, you just in general said that people shouldn't start a Patreon. I said, okay, so you know that we weren't talking to you through your speakers, right? We're talking to everybody. He's like, no, I understand. So we did not specifically point to Dave and said, you should not have a Patreon, but there is...
Wouldn't it be funny, though, if we singled somebody out?
Yeah.
Dave, if you're listening, you specifically don't start a... Can you imagine that? You're like at home drawing, and you're like, oh, God!
What the heck? So here's the deal. There is a Geiger's Law, by the way, that I have talked about in this regard, and it's not the one he mentioned. It's a Geiger's Law of crowdfunding. First comes the crowd, then comes the funding. It's right there in the name. And I still feel that way. In fact, that's, I think, what he's talking about, in that you shouldn't start a Patreon until you've kind of built your audience up.
To be fair, though, can I jump in? Because over the years, you have posited many things and then called them Geiger's Law. Yeah. You're like, you always got to leave the toilet seat down when you leave. That's Geiger's Law. All right, anybody uses the paper towels, you got to pull it out just enough for the next person. That's Geiger's Law. Like anything in life, you're like, oh, that's a Geiger's Law. That's Geiger's
right.
Law
right
there.
I expect people to be keeping this on a list at home up there on their on their studio wall.
Like, are they numbered? Because I feel like I'm not joking. I feel like there's at least 3 or 4 Geiger's
Laws
now.
There's at least 4. I've got to go back and see, because I just say, well, yeah, that's Geiger's Law of crowdfunding, Geiger's Law of merchandising. I got to see.
Because you also have the 28 C's of social media, whatever that thing is.
We've gotten it back down to 4. We've gotten it back down to 4.
And just for fun, because I always love putting you on the spot.
I was just going to say, don't do this.
Before we move on, what are the 4 C's of social media? It's always fun to put you on the spot.
All right. Content. Commercial. The one where you like a
creation?
Museum, no, content,
curation,
curation, content, commercial, curation, and not kindness, but compliment.
Kindness would have been amazing.
I cannot not say kindness.
The 4 C's of social media. Oh my God. Always funny. I want everybody to know, by the way, that Beth and I, mainly Beth, have put together a magnet that we're at some point we're going to put up for Comic Lab that has Dr. Geiger's 4 C's of social media, and the 4th one is a K. It's like kindness or whatever. I'm sort of curious if anybody would want one of those. Let us know, because we made the dang thing and we haven't done it yet, frankly. And I don't know why. I think it's because we don't have a good system to sell quote-unquote things through Comic Lab, you know?
Yeah, and she did a remarkably beautiful illustration of somebody that looks much better than me, but is still close enough to say it's me. She did a very good drawing of
me. She made it look like one of those snake oil salesmen in the late Victorian period that would go around with a wagon, yeah, like selling love potions, you know?
Snake oil. So here's the deal. Here's what I want you to know. When we say don't start a Patreon right away, I guess there is a better way to put that. And that is, you could start a Patreon as long as you understand that you're not going to get a lot of response. Okay. Right. In other words, manage your expectations. Okay. And you could start a Patreon that I would say, if you're just starting out, like Dave here, he's 3 months in. Okay. Right. You can't have big expectations there.
No.
If you wanted to start a Patreon, you certainly could. And you could put that out there. And I would say this would be perfectly appropriate to have a $2 level that is, you know, a support-based level. This is where we're in tip jar territory, right?
Right.
Support the artist, help to make this thing go. Absolutely. And you could put up, you know, sketches and stuff like that, whatever you feel is appropriate. And as long as you manage your expectations, I think you're going to do that. You would be just fine. What I was trying to prevent was a lot of what I was seeing, particularly at that particular point in time, where there's a lot of people that were kind of like treating Patreon like an ATM, like they'd launch a Patreon and they just expected money to come out.
Right.
And,
right.
And in some cases it happened for some people who had the sizable audience that would support that. But I saw a lot of people like, well, this Patreon doesn't work. I started a Patreon and no money is coming out. And you looked and their work wasn't a high enough quality yet. They weren't doing it for a long time. They hadn't done the community building, the audience building. And of course it wasn't going to work. So I guess that's maybe what I was trying to guard against is starting this and with high hopes. But if you really wanted to start a Patreon, knock yourself out as long as you keep your expectations. Because what I don't want you to do as well is start this Patreon and then nobody joins and now you feel like a failure.
Right, right. I think, I have a lot of thoughts about this actually, but just to springboard off of Brad real quick, I think low expectations and manageably low expectations are the way to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of, you want to approach your Patreon as you're starting out like Brad's wife, where you've set your expectations really low, if anything pleasant happens, then you're super excited about it, right?
That woman is a portrait in low expectations. We've been married for a very long time, and you don't get there without lowering those expectations
a little bit. You want to think of your Patreon like Brad's wife does, where low expectations, and then if there's any activity at all, hooray, that's great.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
If he does the dishes, hurrah. You know, that's awesome. What unwarranted abuse that was. That came out of nowhere.
A low expectation for threshold and a low threshold for surprise. Like, oh, look at that. He wiped his feet before coming in the door.
My God.
This is beautiful.
He's trainable.
Yeah, she's a portrait in low expectations.
It's I was gonna
Would you like to share your thoughts with the rest of the class?
I don't know why I was going to say this, but it's like when the zookeepers finally trained the silverback to stop flinging his poop. They're like, oh, then we trained him. We did it.
Look at that. Everybody goes out to the bar and has a beer. Look at that. We trained the silverback.
Hey, the silverback. I don't know why that
No more cleaning poo off
the
window.
I want to say, this is my guilt immediately springing in. I feel bad about this immediately with this series of jokes. Anyway, so yeah, Patreon, let's talk about this. So I actually have a lot of thoughts about this. The first one is that it is funny to see that what's new is exactly what's old, and that when we first started podcasting and first started sharing what we knew about making a living in webcomics, the first questions we always got back in the day is, when do I make my first t-shirt? When do I start putting together my first t-shirt? When do I put together a magnet or pins or books? And all the time we would say, like, just please put your focus on making good comics, because the comics have to come first for the first year, the first 2 years, the first 3 years, whatever it is. Just make good comics first, and then you'll know in your heart of hearts. And everyone's always like, yeah, but when do I do the next thing? I'm excited to do the next thing. And we're like, we get it, but just stick to the comics. And the same thing is kind of true with this question, and I sympathize with it because everybody's excited to get going. You know, you just want to be like, all right, I'm a couple months in. I'm excited. I want to do the next thing.
Yes, yes.
And so even though I actually agree with Brad, sure, if you want to do Patreon, knock yourself out. Put it up. That's fine. You certainly can't hurt yourself if you get a few extra bucks for beer and pizza money every month, right? No, no harm, no foul. But one of the things that I would say is it a little bit distracts you from making comics in those first months. If you're like, got to figure out how to set up this Patreon. Okay, got to figure out how to link my bank account to my Patreon.
Yes.
Okay, got to figure out a couple of graphics for this Patreon page. Okay, got to write up a blog for this Patreon page.
Yes.
And then you're like, you're not really doing the comics anymore. And that's, listen, that's going to come. You're going to have to do all that. But what, I guess what I'm saying is keep putting in the work first, and then when it's irresistibly strong that people are clamoring to give you money for a Patreon.
Right.
In the same way that we used to say when it's so noticeable that people are like, I got to have this as a shirt. And it's not just the one guy that always emails you.
Yep.
It's got to be 50, 60, 70 people emailing you. Then you know, Brad?
That's the whole thing. You nailed it on the head, and that's why I'm worried about that. You know, being too encouraging is because it's a big distraction, and that you know, unless this person has lightning in a bottle, 3 months in, chances are very, very low that this is going to be anything but a distraction. And this is the time that they should be hyper focused on doing the comic and doing it well, and finding out, well, you know, what are the hurdles that need to be cleared in terms of making it better. You're bringing back so many memories when we did that first book, the How to Make Webcomics book. We experienced what we called the 9 month itch. Right. People would launch their web comics and 9 months later, when they weren't famous, they would write us and complain that we had led them wrong, that we had given them false information. And clearly we were lying about everything that we've put in the book, because they had been doing this for 9 whole months.
Nine months, Brad.
And they weren't famous yet.
Yeah.
And that's really what I'm worried about, is that this becomes a distraction. And I wish I could say, okay, set your Patreon up, and if it'll get it off of your chest, and then go back to the comic. But you're right, Dave. Then it becomes, well, maybe I need to put a new icon on my Patreon. Maybe I need to tweet about my Patreon more. Maybe I need a different thing. And it just becomes such a distraction, where what I want this guy to do, or anybody who's in this position, is spend the next 2 years laser sharp. In fact, I've said before, I think when you first start out, I'd love to see you stay off of social media, other than just to do the bare heartbeat. Just stay off of social media, because I want you to be hyper focused on that comic during that time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so again, if the positive reinforcement of having a Patreon page up where five people, and I'm not saying this diminutively, where five people can give you a few bucks, and that reinforces the joy of it for you, then I get it.
Yes.
Honor your heart and honor the fact that that positive feedback is helping you. And so by all means, set up a Patreon, have it. But I guess what we're saying is, just the spirit of the idea is that keep working on the comic first, right? You know, you're not going to hurt yourself by having a Patreon. In fact, there's a lot to be said for getting one up eventually and just having it working for you in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'm saying is, don't let it steal from the thunder of creating the comic itself, focusing on the comic, honing your writing, working on your line work, any of that, rather than creating images for Patreon.
Yeah, and don't let that color how your sense of satisfaction of your comic, because what's going to happen right now when you post a comic and you're getting some, maybe some comments on your comic, that feels exhilarating. And what's going to happen, you're going to set that Patreon up and you're going to post the next comic and you're going to get comments, but no pledges. And now you're not going to be quite as exhilarated. Now you're going to have a feeling of defeat and failure to deal with. And that's going to make it harder for you to get into the fourth month.
Right. Right. And that's more Brad's wife in the first year of marriage. You know, that's yes. more until she oh had rebalanced God. Her expectations. You know, that's that's more. I don't know where I'm going with this. But also, like, I want to say that are there people that caught lightning in a bottle? Sure. I mean, like when Strange Planet launched a year or two ago mm-hmm. from Nathan Pyle. Absolutely, inarguably, caught lightning in a bottle and took off like a rocket. But here's the thing that people forget was that Nathan was making comics for how many years, Brad, before that?
Oh, my God, decade. Like he had been doing this for a long time. I'd say at least 10, if not going on 20 years. Like, yeah, he's been doing this for, and at a high echelon. This guy, I think, was a New Yorker cartoonist. This guy was doing very, very well. He wasn't a household name the way he is now, but he was doing just fine. For himself.
And also, the other one I could think of maybe is like Nancy when it relaunched, right? Like, first yep. of all, existing properties are already well known, but journalists and critics and fans loved it. It took off like a rocket. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, had been creating comics for a long time before Nancy got relaunched, you know?
Yes.
And so you can't just, put in the work is what we're saying. Like, you, yeah. by all means, you can launch a Patreon, but we're really advising you to keep plugging away at the comic because once the comic gets so good that people are clamoring for a Patreon, boy, then you've hit the best of both worlds, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're ready to go.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I want to say a huge thank you and a shout out to our friends over at Wacom and the new Wacom One for sponsoring the show. The Wacom is at WACOM.com. Both Brad and I have one in the studio, and they've been kind enough to sponsor the show for gosh knows how long now. And it has been delightful to have them on board because it is a tool that we can wholeheartedly endorse.
Yes, absolutely. And I, like we've said, we've been using them almost exclusively for some of our at-home work. And Dave, I know Beth uses it for coloring, and I cannot say enough how thrilled I am with the top-level pro-quality results that I get with my Wacom One. It never ceases to amaze me, and we're thinking about this November, maybe getting out of the house for a little while, like we did when we were having the housework done last time, and I'm just looking forward to being able to easily pack that Wacom One up, throw it in the trunk of the car, go up to the mountains, unpack, and have my own little workstation right there. No muss, no fuss.
I didn't know you were thinking about leaving the house in November. That's
for a little bit. Maybe. We'll see.
You know what the idea that my wife floated to me the other day? She goes, "What would you say if we moved to New Zealand for a year?" And I was like, "Wait, what?" And she's like, "You see how good they've been handling COVID?" And I was like, "Yeah, that is interesting. I got to say." She's like, "We quarantine once we land in Auckland for 2 weeks, and then we get to live in New Zealand." I was like, "No, that is tempting. I don't know."
That sounds amazing.
Wouldn't mind packing that walking up and moving down to Auckland for a year, bro.
But wait a minute. What's the time change? I'd have to record Comic Lab at 3 o'clock in the morning. Do I have a vote in this?
No, you don't. I think absolutely the three a.m. is the only not certainly not going to be me recording at 3 a.m. So you're going to have to change your.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, we looked at the price of doing that. We're like, oh well, we'll just stay here in the U.S.
Yeah, maybe we'll just slug it out here in L.A.
Slug it out here.
Okay, so listen, Dave, we've got another Patreon question from our $5 Patreon backer. This one comes in from Jeff Mum, who says, when you transitioned from the phase of, quote, toiling in obscurity, unquote, to becoming more established with a fan base, what new unexpected challenges and fears did you face, and how did you overcome them?
Okay. That's a great question. Yeah. I've got a lot of answers to that, actually, Brad. So do you mind if I jump in first?
I don't think you will.
Since you asked the question. So here I go. All right. So Jeff, there's a weird, two-sided or two-edged sword, in starting to find success. One mm-hmm. is, hooray, the money's starting to come in. And then the next one is from a bookkeeping perspective. Oh, no, the money's starting to come in.
Yes.
Because both from a banking tracking standpoint, a tax standpoint, a compliance standpoint, a business filings for all the different tax locales that on the city level, county level, state level, federal mm-hmm. level, that is a hassle and a half and is a learning curve. That, you know, one of the things they always jokingly say in politics, or not in politics, but they're always like, well, I got to support small business, whatever. But it is actually kind of tricky to get started. Like, it does take a hot minute to figure out who you have to pay taxes to. Because I honestly did not know, Brad, that I had to pay business tax both on the city level, the county level, the state level, and the federal level.
Yeah.
That's a lot of different taxes to have to be in compliance with. And then also collecting sales tax, which is a different state tax. And then I get frustrated just thinking about it. So, Jeff, that's a hassle in success that you have to start dealing with, and you got to get better at it. And you either have to pay someone to do it for you, or you have to learn it yourself. And I have done a hybrid model where I learned early on that the mistakes that I could make myself, Jeff, could generate a $100 fine here, a $200 fine here. But if I hand over my finance to someone else to handle it, that could generate someone walking away to Mexico with tens of thousands of dollars. You know, like I've seen too many friends in Hollywood. They're like, I let my manager handle it. Oh, where'd my manager go?
Exactly,
that kind of thing, you know?
Exactly.
And so I have learned that the mistakes that I can make are all manageable size mistakes. It's always like, hey, you're 2 days late for this city tax. That's an extra $100. And I'm like, God damn it. All right. Well, I'll calendar that better for next year. And I'll accept that that's my cost of doing business for doing it myself. You know, that kind of thing. So taxes are one thing. And then I will say, Jeff, that one of the things as careers have gone on, and I've been lucky enough to hire a couple different assistants as we've gone on. And then Beth, I think we're coming up on year four. She can correct me probably immediately after this. I think we're coming up on year four. This is the longest one and the most successful. And there is a weird sort of responsibility that you have to your business now that you have an employee or that you're paying. And it's a stress that I can only compare to parenting, where you're worried about it, that if you don't do the thing or if you don't perform, that another person is going to suffer for it, right? So like me working by myself, for myself, alone in my studio, if I had to go down to noodles for a while and in those early years and just eat ramen, then that's what I would have done. And that's not a problem. And also, there's enough of that scrappiness in me that if I had to ever go back to that to start over again, I could figure it out. Like I know that it would be 2 or 3 years and I'd rebuild my business and that's that. But there's a unique sort of pressure slash guilt slash anxiety that comes with having an employee, because you're like, I can't F this up because I can't have to fire them or let them go or lay them off or anything because I messed up or because I didn't do the thing, whatever it was. Do you know what I mean, Brad? Can you relate to that thought?
Yeah. That's something I can absolutely relate to. And also, we've talked about this on the show before. The other thing is, when I had a day job and I was sneaking in comics in between being a father and having a day job and then putting some time together in between there, I was a wizard at time management. Because as it turns out, when you have very little time, it's easy to manage it. Right. I only had a couple hours. I mean, I always used to feel so proud of myself. And really, because it wasn't a time management issue at that point, it was an endurance issue. It was, I'd already done my father thing. I'd already done my, member of the family thing. I had already done my employee thing at the newspaper. And it was a measure of endurance to then go on and do the cartoonist thing. It wasn't a time management issue. It was an endurance issue. And when I left my day job and became a full-time cartoonist, all of a sudden I'm like, well, this is going to be really easy because I'm a time management wizard. All of a sudden, when I had more time, I had a whole lot more difficulties managing it.
Right, because you were no longer just keeping your head above water time-wise.
Right.
Now you're like, okay, now I actually have 8 to 10 hours a day to plan out, and I actually don't have the skill set to plan this out.
And I also had the luxury of not doing things every now and again. Like I've said, you know, my kids and I have been watching TV together after dinner. Well, I could never do that in the past. And it's such a luxury to be able to do it. I enjoy it on such a higher level, just the act of sitting on the couch with your kids watching TV.
Pardon me for laughing. It just sounds so funny. Just the act of sitting. Dear God, it's so lovely
sit.
I am so old. It's so nice. Just let Grandpa sit for a minute. You kids have fun.
You don't know how nice it is just to sit.
I don't know why. I'm now imagining Brad at like the Easter egg hunt. And it's like, no, you kids run around. Grandpa's just going to sit down for a minute. It's very hot this April.
Grandpa, you sure you don't want to come out and play jump rope? No, you don't know how much I enjoy sitting. Jumping, not so much, but sitting, this is... I'm on top of the world right now.
I was a web cartoonist in my 20s with two jobs. I have earned the right to just sit. I'm just going to sit.
Just let me sit. Yeah, but well, yes, the sitting part is a joy, but also the togetherness and the shared experience is something that I just, I crave, because for a lot of times it was difficult to find the time to do that. I was there. I was able to do fatherhood stuff, and it's not like I ignored my kids by any stretch of the imagination, but the idea of sitting down and watching TV, that's something that I would have in the past easily said, I'm going to catch up with you later. Enjoy your show. I'm going to go do this.
Right.
Playing at the park, I was there for. Sitting and watching TV, that was something that was easier for me to say, no, that's okay. You guys enjoy, have fun. Now I can do it.
Right.
It's harder for me to say no to that kind of stuff because it's stuff I wanted to do.
I will co-sign on that. That's a really good point. And I'm going to introduce another potential problem with success, Brad.
Yeah.
And this one doesn't get talked as much about because there's very little sympathy for it, which is, Jeff, when you're first starting out and you're trying to get going, and you're like, I just want my career to go. I want to get this. I hope people like my comics. Oh, I really just want to be a cartoonist. And then you kind of start to make it and you're like, oh, all right, people are resonating with it. And the money's coming in. And I guess I can quit my day job. Now I'm a cartoonist. And then the fear, Jeff, switches to become, oh, I hope I'm able to stay relevant. I hope people still like it. Like, even though I'm still a good cartoonist, my fear then becomes, well, what if the mood of the zeitgeist changes and people don't like what I'm putting out anymore, you know?
Yeah. Oh, there's Dave, I've joked with you before that the one thing that I can do way better than you is denial. And part of that is, you know, when you get to the top of a really, really tall building, what's the first thing they say to you when you're out on the ledge? And hopefully you're not spending a whole lot of time on tall building ledges, but let's say you're at the top of a tall building. What's the first thing they say to you?
Don't look down.
Don't look down. Now imagine the building that you're on top of is made out of a house of cards. That's my life. And if I look down and think about it, I'm going to fall. But as long as I don't think about it, I do just fine. But if I think about how frail and fragile this structure that I'm standing on the top of
rickety the damn
actually
thing is that we've built.
Oh, boy. I would turn into Lou Costello in that Egyptian pyramid. Yeah. I can't think about how frail it is. I do just fine, and then I put it out of my mind, and I go right barreling forward, and I do fine. But if I ever stop and think too long about it, I do bad.
Yeah, there's two kind of fears with success, Jeff. And one is, like, let's say you're a cartoonist and you've landed with the biggest publisher going and they got you a big contract, right? So then your fear becomes, what if they go under? What if the editor changes? What if they decide not to go with my book? What if, and all of those are third-party fears of, like, what if they do something to F this up? Because there's such a money stream for you that you're dependent on them, right? That's one kind of fear. But then there's another kind of fear, like Brad and I have, where our table is being held up instead of one big leg in the middle, like a scholastic publisher that's holding up our career. Mm-hmm. Our tables are held up by 1,000 little legs, each one of which is made up of McDonald's straws holding up the table, right? So we've got Patreon, we've got Kickstarter, we've got individual website sales, we've got Google AdSense, we've got convention sales, we've got eBay and commissions and all this sort of stuff, right? And each one individually could fail, but boy, do we get nervous if any one of them starts to falter, because you start to have 2, 3, 4 of those straws holding up your table falter, and you go, it's not looking good.
Yeah, well, that's I forget who said it. It was in the early days of webcomics, and somebody says, you know, my fans, I don't have one boss. My fans are my boss, and it's hard to get fired by 10,000 bosses.
Yes. Rich Stevens said that, yes?
I'm not sure who to attribute.
I'm pretty sure it's
to.
Rich. I want to give the credit there. I think I'm pretty sure that was Rich said that. Yeah, and it's great. You can't get fired. But You get fired by 51 month, 100 a year, and you're like, oh, biscuits.
Yeah,
oh no.
Yeah, I need some new bosses. Yeah, and this all sounds like, oh, gee whiz, you know, it's tough to be me. But it just means that there's a whole new set of challenges that come as you progress. You know, you lose some challenges, you gain the next group of challenges.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's a whole different set of fears. But the big thing that I should have left with, Jeff, is that I wake up most days so grateful and thankful to the people that read me and to the fact that I have a career, that I don't want you to think that all of those challenges and those fears are overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true for all levels of cartooning. Even if I didn't make money off of it, sure, I would be sad. But there is a joy in cartooning that I can't replicate in anything else in my life. And I love the fact that I get to do this day in and day out and year in and year out. God, there are worse things in this world than having to live that life. So I am I want you to come away with the thought that, like, I don't go to bed every night anxious about whatever tax filing I have to do. I go to bed going like, this is a nice thing to be a cartoonist and to be able to share this with the world.
Yeah, that's I kind of like that thought of Dave Kellett lying in bed, drifting off, having those last thoughts of the day before the sweet grip of sleep takes him. And I would just only hope that at some point he hears in the back of his head my voice saying, "You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics."
To which I would respond as Brad gently rolls over in bed, "Your hosts have been my friend Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And then me reminding Dave that I prefer to be Big Spoon as I say, "My friend Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And I want you all to visualize a stairway of creativity, of self-actualization, that you can do this. You can chase your dreams." And so we turn with that vision to say the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode and all episodes was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions. Matt knows his self-actualization is the product of joy and spirit and connection with Mother Earth over at www.woodsong.media. I'm sorry. This also reminds me, Brad, that my wife has been listening to meditation tapes as she goes to sleep.
Oh, really?
And I love my wife to the end of time, but she falls asleep within 2 seconds. And then I'm left with some weird Scottish guy going, "Right, actualize your beauty and your inner self-image of love and joy. You alone can make the world a better place, you wee numpty bint." So, like, and I can't reach over her to, like, turn off her iPhone because it wakes her back up. And then she goes, "Meh, what's the matter? What's the matter?" And I go, "I'm trying to turn off your damn Scottish guy who's telling me to self-actualize."
My wife listens to romance audiobooks and she's got it turned up so when she falls asleep, I can hear it through her headphones. And then I'm up all night. I'm like, "Oh, God, what's Ted going to do next?" Oh,
Roger, so turgid.
Turgid.
Turgid is also an amazing word because nothing could sound less sexy than turgid. Oh,
turgid is an amazing word. Turgid and tumescence are two words that are just amazing when you get a chance to use them.
Oh, God. Anyway, so I'm going to jump in on Brad's behalf and say, if you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show over at Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab, so we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
It is always like she's sound asleep, like gently snoring, and I'm by myself and I just staring at the ceiling like, why, God, why? And I just hear someone going, your surroundings here are so calm and pleasant that it brings a feeling of complete peace that washes over your entire body and mind. You breathe in deeply and allow the peacefulness to fill you. You notice the birds singing in the trees. Ah, chirp, chirp, chirp. Look at them chirping. Take the time now to release any of your worries and disturbing thoughts, any sadness you may be feeling. Wish it away. Wish it away. Let those feelings float up in the way, floating far away. Ha!